Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And we are back to this, a story about Washington, D.C. and the American economy in which the phrase "kick the can down the road" features oh so prominently. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 15th of July. President Obama gave a speech today, another speech, I ought to say, on infrastructure and the Highway Trust Fund. That's a pot of money that states use to build roads and bridges. It's about to run out of money, that pot is, in August, in fact, if Congress does nothing. Thing you need to know is that transportation projects have typically been funded on a long-term basis. But Congress being what it is today, that's not going to happen with the trust fund, so we are going to get yet another stopgap bill, what has come to be known as a short-term fix, a patch, if you will. Problem solved? Pfft. Because, as Marketplace's David Gurra reports, there are real consequences to governing this way.
After a while, the fiscal crises kind of blend together, don't they? All the continuing resolutions, the last-minute debt ceiling deals.
This is one heck of a way to run a railroad.
Political strategist Greg Valliere is with the Potomac Research Group.
It makes it very difficult for companies to hire, to plan for benefits, to buy supplies.
And according to Linda Fowler, who teaches government at Dartmouth, short-term legislation is also hard on federal agencies that contract with those companies.
It makes it impossible to have an orderly bidding process to get the best price for people to plan their budgets over the long run and set priorities.
Fowler says these bills take up time and political capital.
This is just very inefficient and wasteful.
What could become landmark legislation falls to the wayside. Immigration reform, tax reform. Matt Dickinson is a political scientist at Middlebury.
A lot of the issues out there that you think can be solved and will be solved more easily if they're addressed earlier as opposed to later aren't getting addressed at all.
This dysfunction dates back at least a decade, David Cannon says. He's a poli-sci professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. At first, it affected budget issues. And programs like the Highway Trust Fund, which funnels money into both Democratic and Republican districts, were safe.
Everyone loves building highways, and now we can't even agree on funding that.
Cannon says that as the government lurches from deadline to deadline, it's capable of doing real damage. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
Just realized nobody actually said kick the can down the road in that piece. How about that? All right, the corporate word, oh, this Tuesday is inversion. Here you go. I'm going to use it in a real-life example for you. The Chicago-based drug maker AbbVie is in merger talks with the Irish drug company Shire. If they do make the deal, they are going to run off to the island of Jersey together. Why? Because Jersey has tax rates that are a heck of a lot lower than they are in Chicago, Illinois, U.S. of A., a mere 13%, in fact. AbbVie would, of course, love to lower its tax bill from the 35% it pays right now. That is a textbook case of corporate inversion, an American company buying an overseas competitor and then moving right in to reap the tax benefits. But as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports, it's a money-saving tactic that does not come cheap.
AbbVie is offering $53 billion for Shire. It links up with another company and in the process saves a bundle on taxes. Arizona State accounting professor Don Goldman says moves like this are especially tempting when competitors do the same.
It's kind of a no-brainer that if you have a transaction that would allow you to do this, you need to be doing it or you're going to get left behind.
Big banks are helping convince companies to move abroad, says Berkeley Law professor Stephen Davidoff Solomon.
What's going on now is a feeding frenzy. Every investment banker now has a slide deck that they're taking to any possible company and saying, you have to do a corporate inversion now, because if you don't, your competitors will.
The math is simple, but international mergers rarely are. Dealing with legal requirements of a new country can be complex, and there are invariably cultural issues to handle. And Steve Rosenthal of the Tax Policy Center points out, companies that do inversions can take a real image hit.
To shift their profits overseas, to some, seems unpatriotic. And I think that's a real public relations concern.
Members of Congress are stomping their feet about the current wave of corporate runaways, but partisan gridlock means they're unlikely to change anything soon. Mihir Desai is a Harvard Law and Business professor who says it's no longer a given that companies will be meaningfully part of America or any country.
You can have a financial home in New York, you can have a legal home in a tax haven, and your management can sit in London. So that notion that firms are of a country, I think, is going away.
There's an ongoing debate about how to tax corporations here fairly, but more and more companies are basically exiting that argument, and the country itself. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Janet Yellen did the congressional testimony thing today. Nothing extraordinaire from the Fed chair. Wall Street kind of yawned. In point of fact, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. As you slide on into the second half of the summer, the outdoor living and the nice weather, go ahead and take a deep breath for me. All that fresh air we've got, it wasn't always there. It comes to us thanks to a decades-long fight, a fight that involved industry and government and citizens demanding that the smog that once affected so many cities around this country be cleaned up. That fight led to the Clean Air Act and the Environmental Protection Agency, and it's a fight that 1.3 billion Chinese have just begun. As part of our series, We Used to Be China, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has this story of Beijing's most recent battle against smog.
They say you don't know what you've got until it's gone. For the people of Beijing in 2008, it was air pollution. Huang Wei is director of Greenpeace's climate and energy program in Beijing.
Up until then, every day the sky was a shade of gray or cream. But in the countdown time to the Olympics, the sky suddenly turned blue. Many of us, people of all ages, would stop in the street and marvel at how wonderful it was.
How'd they do it? Beijing shut down factories, restricted traffic, and improved public transportation to make the Summer Games a blue sky Olympics.
The footprints in their history stretch back 5,000 years.
The NBC intro to the opening ceremony of the 2008 Olympics in Beijing asked a crucial question.
China is welcoming the world. Who will they be when this is over?
In terms of the air, the answer became clear after the closing ceremony. Beijing was right back where it started. As the blue sky disappeared behind the familiar veil of smog, the people of Beijing had learned a valuable lesson, says Zhang Jianyu, China director for the Environmental Defense Fund.
The Olympic Games revealed to everyone, the government and the people, that in terms of solving our air pollution problem, it can be done.
But for the next 5 years, China's government let the pollution get worse. At the same time, the U.S. Embassy in Beijing installed an air monitor on its building and began broadcasting hourly levels of a range of pollutants. Greenpeace's Huang Wei.
Up to that point, China's government reported the air quality, but it wasn't very specific. If the pollution level reached a certain point, they might publish it as simply bad.
People in Beijing downloaded smartphone apps that recorded the U.S. Embassy's hourly air quality index, and everyone began to memorize what the numbers meant. 0 to 50 meant the air was good, rarely the case. An average air quality reading in Chinese cities hovers around 150, labeled unhealthy. But sometimes it climbs into the 300 to 500 range, prompting the government to urge people to stay inside.
Well, when it's 400, I don't ride my bike anymore.
Zhou Xizhou is director at IHS Energy in Beijing. In the winter of 2012-13, pollution levels went beyond the U.S. Embassy's own index, forcing airports to shut down because pilots couldn't see the runway. The international press dubbed it the airpocalypse.
There is the physical side. You feel it. I do feel it in my eyes. But then for a lot of people, it's also, I think, psychological. Just being in a gray, you know, polluted environment, you feel somewhat suppressed.
That winter in Beijing saw air quality index readings climbing towards 1,000. As a comparison, when the air quality in Paris hit 150 this year, the city instituted a driving ban and offered free public transportation. But there is good news, says Joe.
What's encouraging, I think, being in the energy sector the past couple of years is that we are seeing unprecedented actions and determination to address this issue.
Joe says China's way of addressing air pollution, though, is different from the American approach of the 1960s and 70s. That was the era of tough legislation and the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency. China's government prefers the mandate.
For example, just issuing a mandate saying that every coal-fired power station in Beijing will be gone by the year 2016. You can't do that in America.
China's top-down authoritarian regime may inspire hope that China could clean up its air with a few snaps of its leader's fingers. But in China, central power has limits. Local governments in China often disregard new mandates and laws handed down from Beijing because there's often no funding to implement them. Peking University's Xu Jintao explains.
China's local governments have no motivation at all to deal with environmental problems unless they make money. That's why I think a pollution tax would work. If some of that revenue goes to fund the local government, they'll quickly help solve this problem.
Using London as a model, Beijing has plans for a traffic congestion charge next year from drivers who enter the city. Xu says implementing these kinds of measures now, while China's consumer culture is still young, is important because it frames a new social mindset.
China's growth model is based on the idea that natural resources are free. We've never considered clean water, clean land, or clean air as scarce resources. But now in China, they are scarce. Nothing is free. When you go to the market, you won't find free cabbage. You need to pay for it. And now Chinese consumers will need to pay for clean air, land, and water.
But the Environmental Defense Fund's Zhang Jianyu isn't sure the Chinese will sacrifice the perks of being consumers just to save the environment.
Everyone in China now wants a car, and it's hard to deny them that. If China's 1.3 billion people live like Americans, planet Earth is finished. That's my biggest concern. How can you deprive the Chinese of their right to become consumers and live a modern lifestyle?
It's a path the U.S. has already traveled, polluting much of the world in the process. Now it's China's turn. If the U.S. and other developed countries don't help China clean up, says Zhang, the smog that plagued L.A. in the 1950s will return. Except this time, it'll be blowing from across the Pacific. In Beijing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got a timeline of air pollution from back when coal started fueling the Industrial Revolution to events in China today. It is, of course, at marketplace.org. Also, we'd appreciate it if you'd send us your pictures of your city's air, your blue sky, gray sky, smokestacks, whatever you got. Post them to Instagram with the hashtag MarketplaceSmogCheck. Hollywood, home of the mega blockbuster $100 million or more movie, has put itself on something of a budget, at least when it comes to making somewhat funny movies. Five out of six comedies released this summer cost less than $50 million to produce. Not a pittance, I know, but no blockbuster budget either. And it's working out pretty well for the studios. A couple of those movies have made back five times their budgets at the box office. Sharon Waxman is the editor-in-chief at The Wrap. Sharon, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So how is it now that Hollywood has discovered they can make comedies on the cheap and make a whole lot of money?
They're making a lot of them. The cost of making a comedy has dropped less than half in 4 years. From 2010, the average cost of a major studio comedy went from $74 million for the production cost down to $33 million on average. That's remarkable.
Is that because people have realized that Adam Sandler is not worth $25 million to make a movie, or what's the deal?
Yeah, that is absolutely part of
the
reason. A good example, Adam Sandler had a movie called Blended this summer, which was not particularly successful, but it's still going to make money. It's not going to make $100 million at the box office here,
right,
like most Adam Sandler comedies have in the past, but it's still going to make a profit. Then you've got movies like Neighbors, which are going to make a lot of money. All of these movies are in pretty much the $30-35 million range. So they've figured out how to pay the talent less. And the other thing we have traditionally found is that comedies don't particularly translate overseas. And of course, we know that the overseas box office is 70% now of the global box office take. So you have to think often global first. And that's what they're doing.
There was a line in the piece that you guys had on this. One of the producers for the new Seth Rogen film, the Neighbors, or Neighbors, Neighbors, I guess, which mm-hmm. we talked about. Their goal when they talk to studios about this is to find out the most money that a studio will give them and then go away. That is, they don't want studios messing with their kind of comedy.
Yeah, well, that makes sense because producers never want the studios messing with anything right. that they're doing. But if the studios have less at risk, obviously they're going to be less involved.
Oh, yeah.
My question is, can we find a way to budget dramas around the same kind of model that's working for these comedies? That's my question because some of us like character-driven dramas.
Answer your own question then, can we? I mean, there's more people watching movies out there than just people who like to go see stupid comedies.
Well, that's true. And the more good movies that there are at the theater, the more people want to go. So it remains for some smart producers to put together those business pieces, that model, in the same way that the smart comedy producers are, the Judd Apatows of the world. Yeah. And the Adam Sandler producers have already, the Bad Robots have already done.
That's true. All right, back to the task at hand and comedy here, just as a way to close this thing out. It doesn't always work, right? And I'm thinking here of Melissa McCarthy and Tammy, which opened 4th of July weekend and did, honestly, kind of meh at best.
Meh. However, this formula still holds. I don't think Tammy is going to lose money. Yes, it got creamed by Transformers, which is a global hit.
Right.
But Tammy will still make money. It's just not going to make as much money as they would have liked. And so they'll probably let Melissa McCarthy make another movie with her husband, Ben Falcone.
Sharon Waxman is the editor-in-chief at The Wrap. Sharon, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
the beeper would go off and we would go, put on the suit and go out.
Dead people. That's all I'm going to say. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ticked up just 5 points today, less than a 10%, 17,060. The blue chips. The NASDAQ slipped 24 points, 0.5%, ended things at 44.16. The S&P 500 erased nearly 4 points, 0.2%, ended the day at 19.73. Investors drifted away from tech stocks today. Twitter, Facebook, Pandora, and TripAdvisor all slid more than 1%. Biotech stocks were especially hard hit. Amgen off 1.75%, Biogen off 2.5%. Banks did better thanks to positive earnings news from Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, both of which said their trading businesses did all right. Goldman lifted 1.33%. J.P. Morgan popped up 3.5%. Day bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Gatebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the June Producer Price Index. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. And starting July 16, 1935, drivers in Oklahoma City had to shell out a nickel to park in some spots when the first parking meters were installed. Soon, drivers all across the country were digging for change. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal with some news from the future for you. Archie Andrews is going to die tomorrow. Not Archie the teenager. He'll be back as usual in next month's issues of Archie Comics and some other titles. The one who is going to die is a grown-up version of Archie in a series called Life with Archie, featuring stories about Archie as a married adult. Each one of those issues features two versions of Archie's grown-up life, one where he's married to Betty, the other where he's married to Veronica, because, hey, it's the comics, right? But anyway, both of those guys die tomorrow. Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains how killing Archie the character is going to help keep Archie the brand alive.
Archie gets shot defending his friend Kevin Keller, who's gay and married and running for office. Archie has kids and a job. Here's Jonathan Goldwater, CEO of Archie Comics.
It's not your traditional high school Archie. It's Archie aged up just a little bit.
And grown-up Archie's a hit. Goldwater estimates the comic sells more than 75,000 copies an issue, a lot more than an issue of Archie Comics. Just as important as the narrative tweaks, Life with Archie comes in a different size and shape, one that goes on magazine racks in supermarkets and bookstores, not just comic shops.
Basically, the 32-page comic book on the newsstand is going away, and most of the sales now on the traditional comic book are in the comic book shops.
Archie Comics' other big hit is Afterlife with Archie, in which the gang from Riverdale live through the zombie apocalypse. I'm told some of them try to eat each other. And just as important, it's published as a series of graphic novels sold in bookstores. The latest issue was the biggest-selling graphic novel for June, according to the blog Comicron. John Jackson Miller, who runs the site, says fans know better than to take the death of a character seriously. He quotes a friend of his, a longtime comic book writer and editor named Len Wein.
No one in comics is ever really dead unless you can see the body, and usually not even then.
Killing a character is also a time-tested way to grab extra sales. Superman died in 1992, and Captain America died in 2007. Both sold lots of comics, and both came back. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Sometimes, and we've probably all done this, you take a job because you need the money, not necessarily because you want to do whatever it is as a career. And the job is kind of weird to boot, maybe even a little bit gross, but it shapes you in a way. That, in a nutshell, is the backstory of a new memoir out from Andrew Meredith. It and the job he did is called The Removers. Andrew, thanks for coming into the studio.
Good to be here.
This is... It's a complicated book, man. It's a complicated
you
book.
You think so, really?
Yeah, I kind of do. Long story short, you're 14. Your father is dismissed from his position teaching literature at a local college for what you at the time only know is vague charges of sexual harassment, right?
Right.
You go into a tailspin for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And the book starts with you and your dad going out to pick up a dead body.
Yeah.
So go ahead and tell us what that job was, I guess, is the place to start.
Yeah, we worked for a local service that contracted with funeral homes. So, you know, the funeral director would get a call saying so-and-so has died. We need her to be picked up often at home. And then they would farm out the job to these guys who worked for the service. So, you know, we would get a beep in 1998, as it was.
Yeah.
The beeper would go off and we would go, put on the suit and go out.
The first one, not the first one, but the one that opens the book, the opening scene, is somewhat gruesome.
Yeah.
A gentleman had passed a week or so earlier in the Philadelphia summertime. But you were pleased as punch to be working with your dad, to be on the job.
Yeah, it was different. It was a change of venue, you know? No matter how gruesome the venue was, it was better than being at home with him, you know, because home was so fraught.
And it's hard because this is a job in which there is an aspect of public relations is wrong, but dealing with other people, right? I mean, you have to go in and there's the bereaved and there's, I mean, you are in there at the moment of death.
Yeah.
Or shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And there's the grieving widow or the brother-in-law or whatever it is.
Right.
And you have to engage personally and then turn around and do this thing.
Yeah. You need a manner. And that's
good word.
That develops.
How?
Just from experience. And you know, you pick up cues over time about what makes people calm down and feel better.
Did you learn by watching your father?
For sure. He was one of the best at that manner, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was really good at going into a home and making people feel like he was in charge, that everything would be fine, that you'd be hearing from the funeral director in the morning, nothing to worry about. Maybe you should go into the kitchen so you don't see us leave, you know.
This is a job in which you were basically required to be invisible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in point of fact, you actually, later on in the book, you come out to L.A., you work in a hotel in high-end, you know, customer service and room service. Again, a job in which you're required to be invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? That's something about you, I guess,
well,
right?
That really fit my personality. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's the writerly personality. I just wanted to shrink away and watch people. So, of course, I wrote a memoir.
Yeah, well, and how did that come about? What's the thought process that led you to say, I need to write about this? Because at the time the events of this book is happening, this is going to sound a little harsh, but you're a screw-up. I mean, you're 19, 20, 21 years old, still living in your parents' basement.
Yeah.
You know,
I was on the second floor, guys.
Second floor, all right, man. Well, there you go. But, you know, you're pounding, what was it, Schlitz or something? Or, you know, Pabst, PBR, whatever it was.
A lot of Miller Lite, a lot of Yingling. Yeah.
Drinking Camel Lights unfiltered and all that stuff.
I always had the sense that I wanted to Right. You know, I mean, from the time I was a little kid, that was my talent. And I knew I wouldn't write anything worthwhile until I wrote about this.
Hmm.
And I tried it in several different forms. You know, when I first started to do removals, I started to write a screenplay called The Removers.
No, really? You can totally see that movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You could totally. I mean, it wouldn't be Henry Winkler Night Shift, right? It would be way better than that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, the Removers as a title has been with me for 15 years. You know, I knew I needed to make The Removers somehow.
That's great. Andrew Meredith, his first book, it is a memoir, as I said, is called The Removers. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's great.
Marketplace is supported by Battelle. Every day, the people of Battelle apply science and technology to solving what matters most. More at battelle.org. And by Slacker Radio, delivering handcrafted streaming radio to the web, smartphones, and tablets with over 13 million songs and talk programs, including Marketplace. More at slacker.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which direct democracy is practiced here in the Golden State kind of shoots itself in the foot. I don't know if you heard about this at the time, but a venture capitalist from Silicon Valley offered a proposal late last year to break California into 6 different states. It's not given much of a chance of really going anywhere, but the venture capitalist in question, his name is Tim Draper, announced yesterday he has gathered enough signatures to get it on the ballot in 2016. Two things of note here. No, three, actually. Number one, Silicon Valley and all its money becomes its own state. Handy, huh? If you're a venture capitalist from Silicon Valley. Number two, Central California would instantly become the poorest state in the country by per capita income. And number three, my colleague David Brancaccio talked to Tim Draper about his plan when it came out. That's on the Marketplace Morning Report. It is, if you're curious, online at marketplace.org. And with that, that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up just 4 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ down 26.6%. The S&P 500 gave back 4 points. That is 0.2%. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.